Welcome to the Reformed Journal podcast, where we're talking about faith and church, scripture and theology, as well as culture, politics, history, literature, arts, and the sciences, with thoughtful, interesting people coming at it from a generously Reformed perspective. Find us at reformedjournal.com.
This is Jeff Monroe, editor of the Reformed Journal. I'm delighted today to be joined on the podcast by Brian Elaine and Todd Dethridge. Brian, I don't know what your business card says on it. Maybe it says you're an impresario or something like that. Brian does a lot of things. He leads Writing for Your Life. He leads the website Compassionate Christianity. He puts on writing conferences. Used to be all over the country. Now they're online during COVID. He was the founding director of the Frederick Buechner Center. He worked in the technology world for many years and has an MBA from the Wharton School of Business at Penn. And probably most importantly for many of our listeners, is a member of the Colts Neck Reformed Church in Colts Neck, New Jersey. And he's joined by Todd Dethridge. Todd is the executive director and co-founder of Telos. And before that, had a long career in government, worked in the U.S. State Department, worked as chief of staff for a U.S. senator. And Brian and Todd are co-collaborators in a new book called How to Heal Our Divides. It's a really remarkable book with an incredible list of contributors. And I want to welcome Todd and Brian today to our podcast. And I'm going to start with Brian just to talk a little bit about this book and tell us, kind of give us an overview of it. Tell us about the project, how it came together, and the process of putting it together.
Sure. Well, Jeff, thanks so much for having us on your podcast. We really appreciate it. It's always great to collaborate with you, which we've done on several fronts. So I always appreciate that. There were really two things that happened last year that motivated this book. One was that when the pandemic hit, I was originally supposed to be doing 8 different writers' conferences all over the country, and those all went away. And so I shifted those online, but I also started an interview series called Reading Hope in Trying Times, you know, to allow some of the authors in particular who are going to be speaking at my conference some opportunity to still, you know, get in front of, you know, their audience. So that ended up being really well received. I ended up doing 78 interviews between March and June and just kept getting introduced to new people. So it was just, you know, a great experience that you could tell was hitting a nerve. The second thing is, since I had more time to read last year, I started reading more books about anti-racism, about political divides, about religious divides, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, given that, as well as the overall state of our country, I felt like after the election, I wanted to do something that was around healing divides. As I was reading those books, you know, I kept encountering lots of good books that would deal with either how this problem came about, like the history of it, or convincing you that this issue, or asking you to look inside yourself, you know, to examine your own biases, all really good things. But there was very little written about, okay, what do we do about it? So I wanted to initially do a video interview series, just like the other one that I had done, on healing divides, and focus it on organizations that were actually doing something to heal some type of divides. Again, racial, political, religious. And so that was the initial idea. Then I said, well, why don't I try to turn that into a book? Just ask each one of those people that I'm going to interview to contribute a chapter to the book. And so in November, I started just kind of asking around, you know, some of the people that I knew, what do you think of this idea? Do you have some suggestions of people that I can include? And by Christmas, I was already oversubscribed. You know, I was targeting like 25 to 30 different contributors, and I already had more than that. And with an enthusiastic reaction, both from the contributors as well as other people that I shared this idea with. So I said, okay, not only is it going to be a video series, not only is it going to be a book, I'm going to just turn this whole thing into a full platform, meaning website, social media, podcasts, you know, the whole nine yards. And so that's what got the whole thing started. And, you know, lo and behold, we're 6 months later and we have a book. The book just just came out. Today is the official launch day, May 18th. I still am a little bit in disbelief that it happened that quickly.
Tell us some of the notable people that have contributed to the book.
Brian McLaren, Diana Butler Bass, Frank Thomas, Michael Waters, Shane Claiborne, Parker Palmer, Amy Julia Becker, Mako Fujimura. The list just keeps going on and on. I mean, I'm very fortunate, very blessed to have been able to be supported by so many different people. But beyond the names, the real purpose of the book is to highlight organizations like Todd's that are actually doing something, you know, tangible, practical, feet in the ground, get people involved kinds of organizations that are actually doing something to heal different kinds of divides. So the spotlight needs to be on them. The rest of it is just trying to draw attention to them.
Sure. So how did you become aware of Todd and Telos and what they do in peacemaking?
Well, so around the time when I was just, you know, starting to do this, I saw an article in Religion News Service that was about Telos and Todd. And so I looked through my network and I said, well, let's see, who do I know anybody that knows these folks? And there were a couple of different folks, and I asked one of them for an introduction and immediately connected with Todd, and he immediately thought this was a great idea and was very, you know, supportive and cooperative and helping to put it together.
Great. And so, Todd, tell us a little bit about what Telos does and how it began.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. Appreciate being on here today. So Telos began as an attempt to help Americans understand the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and to understand our role as Americans in it, and to then reshape the way that Americans care about it and engage in ways that allow for conflict resolution and diplomacy and peacemaking to happen, rather than some of the things that drive American policies and engagements now. And so that was sort of that was the beginning. Our mission statement now is broader than Israel-Palestine. Our mission now is that we form communities of American peacemakers across lines of difference to help bring healing to intractable conflict at home and abroad. And our founding is sort of a representation of that too. So Telos was founded in 2009 by Greg Khalil and me. And Greg and I come from very different places, and we come across our own lines of difference through this work together. So I'm from the American South, grew up in a pretty fundamentalist Baptist background, conservative politically, worked in for, you know, Republican member of Congress, served as a political appointee in the Bush administration. And Greg is from, you know, San Diego, California. His parents were both professors. His father was a Palestinian American who'd emigrated from Bethlehem, a Christian who had left Bethlehem and come to the United States as a young man to study and had stayed. And Greg went to Yale, you know, I went to a state school in Arkansas. And so we just couldn't be more different in many ways ourselves. And we came together across our own lines of difference to try to work on the way Americans engage Israel-Palestine. That's taken us to other places now, too. Our primary emphasis is still on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and America's relationship to it, and how do we form communities of peacemakers to engage it differently. But we've also started doing some work in the American South. We have a trip program there and one to South Africa as well. Hmm.
And so immediately when you speak of Israel-Palestine, it is in the news right now, and the conflict is full bore. I think the first thing that pops into my mind is you must have relationships, contacts, people there, people on the ground there. How are people doing?
Yeah, it's in full bore right now, as you said. It's a very dark time. I mean, I'll start. We have two staff members there. Both are Israeli citizens. One is Jewish and lives in Jerusalem. One is Palestinian and lives in Jaffa or Tel Aviv. It's traumatizing to be there, particularly for our person on the ground who's a father of a small child. And he and his wife have to navigate sirens and running in out of safe rooms. And a piece of rocket debris fell on their car the other night and destroyed it. And, you know, that's all going on in his life. But we have friends all over the land, Israelis and Palestinians from one end to the other. And it's just a very, very difficult time for all. It's that time you don't want to happen. When these kinds of hostilities break out, like we're seeing right now, lives are lost and the death toll is mounting each day. There's so much destruction. And then unaccounted ever is really the new traumas and the new grievances that are created by this kind of war and violence. And then the good work that so many are doing for things like coexistence and grassroots peacemaking all regresses during this time as well. And you know, it's not entirely lost, but it's really set back. And so there's just so much loss and so little gain in moments like this. And it's really hard. And it's, you know, tragically, we've seen this before. And so it's not, you know, it's an unresolved conflict that's been going on for decades now. And we have there's sort of ongoing violence of certain kinds. And then there's episodic sort of violence that looks like this. But there's sort of an ongoing reality of the violence of, you know, of occupation and other things that are happening on a day-to-day basis and incidental violence and that sort of thing. And then you have these outbreaks like this that make it really, really hard.
And so how does an organization like yours support peacemaking when something like this is going on?
Well, you know, we have this a grandiose ambition, but it's not so grandiose that we're imagining solving the conflict itself between Israelis and Palestinians. What we're really trying to do is help Americans understand their own role in it, because this is a conflict that takes place half a world away. But because so many Americans care so deeply about it, we also are a party to this conflict. We set the parameters in which a lot of it takes place. We provide funding and weapons and other support into the conflict. And in some ways, we're very much a part of it. And so we're trying to help Americans understand their own role in it. And so what we do in moments like this is, you know, not that much different than what we always do. There was just a sort of a heightened urgency now to help Americans understand the issues better, to understand both the complexity of the situation, but also to find ways to support folks that are trying to, you know, to end hostilities and do the real work that would allow not just the sort of fighting to stop, but some of the core issues to be resolved. And so we're doing a number of things in terms of webinars and podcasts and other, you know, materials using social media and creating other kinds of materials for people to learn and to become active in ways that both educate their neighbors and their families and their own communities, that speak into public forums and that speak to political leadership here in the United States, all those sorts of ways, and becoming active as peacemakers during especially times like this.
And I was just thinking about your work, and as I've become acquainted with it, thinking about, well, you were the primary thing that it looked to me like you were doing was taking people on trips, taking people there into Israel, Palestine, into the American South. And then you have this going on, but you also, even before this, had COVID going on, which would have greatly impacted your ability to do that. So I'm just wondering how peacemaking continues when you can't be there in person, or when you can't take the group there that you'd like to take.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you're right. We have, for the last more than 10 years, we've taken a number of delegations on these very unique pilgrimages where we, if it's a Christian group, and we work with some non-Christian communities and primarily with Christian groups, but others as well. But when we take a Christian group, we're going to the Holy Land and we're going to walk where Jesus walked, but that's about 20% of our time. And the other 80%, we're going to try to walk where Jesus walked today, meeting the real people who live there now in this complex reality, Israelis, Palestinians, Jews, Christians, Muslims. And we believe that relationship is very central to peacemaking. It's a very important part of what you do. But each of us can be agents of healing and peace, even when we can't gather or travel like we've not been able to do for the last, you know, year and plus. We can learn to do a number of things that we teach peacemakers to do all the time, whether we're going or not, learning to listen, to understand, educating ourselves about issues and conflicts, particularly where we are involved, where we have a role. We can always be doing the work of justice with an orientation toward reconciliation. We can always find ways to follow the leadership of those who are from marginalized communities. I mean, there's still things we can do in terms of educating ourselves and becoming active in our own communities around issues where we do have a voice or where things are being done in our name. And so that a lot of our work since the travel pause, which you know has been sort of 14 months ago for us now, a lot of that work has been to help folks understand and take ownership for what they know and find ways to then become active in these different ways.
And so in regards to Israel-Palestine, let's stay there for a minute. What is being done in our name? What is it that you want Americans to be aware of in that particular area?
My own sort of introduction to this conflict was probably through the church. And I didn't grow up with a heavy dose of kind of dispensationalism or other kinds of eschatologies and that sort of thing. But I was exposed to that in the church I grew up in and just in the Christian world I grew up in. So I grew up with some kind of framing in that way. There's sort of some preloaded software that we get early on in many churches in America about how to think about what's going on there. But in my professional life, I worked on this in Washington, first, you know, as an issue on Capitol Hill, and then in the State Department. And what I can tell you is that this is a vexing foreign policy challenge for the United States that has real implications on our own national interests and security, but it functions like a domestic political issue. And what I mean by that is Americans care about it, and we care about it so much that you have to have a position on this to be elected to Congress. And people come into this policy arena with these sort of ideas about it that are often disconnected from some of the realities on the ground, and often disconnected both from American interests even. And because American interests are, in my view, all on the side of peacemaking and conflict resolution, they are not in seeing this conflict continue to perpetuate year after year. That undermines our interests. And yet we often don't act in those ways. So we care about it in ways that are mostly from, especially arising from the Christian community, that are pro-Israel, in ways that actually work themselves out as being anti-Palestinian. There are some pro-Palestine voices that are emerging that sometimes are also anti-Israeli. And what we're trying to suggest is that there's another way to think about all that that's not zero sum, but that appreciates the fact that you if you're going to be pro-Israeli, you have to be pro-Palestinian and vice versa. And the way that you do that is to also be pro-peace, to really try to do the things that allow this conflict to be resolved. Hmm.
And you spoke, you just hinted at this a little while ago, and as I read through the chapter, you speak a lot about the importance of listening, about getting on the ground and listening to people. And so I'm just curious, just maybe your own story and then what you've seen with groups that you've led there. What are some of the lessons that you've learned from just listening in Israel-Palestine or listening in the American South have been significant to you?
Yeah, listening is where you start. It's not where you stop, but it is really the place to start. Paul Tillich, the theologian, says that listening is the first act of love. And I think that's an important thing to kind of keep in mind. I'd say in my own journey into this, it was listening to people from a variety of perspectives around this conflict that opened me up to understanding, again, both the complexity of it and the importance of holding sort of the different realities there in tension, the different narratives and that you hear and experience in some kind of tension, and appreciating the fact that if you're going to get into a different kind of and better future and reality there, you're going to have to listen to the different competing voices and understand what's driving them, what their demands are, underlying that, what their fears and concerns are, and that sort of thing. And so when I started to travel there, when I was at the State Department, and I would meet with Israelis and Palestinians routinely as a part of my work, but even going further and getting sort of off the beaten path and not just meeting with the folks that you meet with and the foreign ministries and the government offices and that sort of thing, but really trying to meet real people, and especially on the ground in places where difficult things are happening, and trying to get as much as possible to understand these realities from a different perspective, then you really begin to change and open up to the idea that there are multiple things that have to be understood here. The physicist Niels Bohr says that the opposite of a fact is a falsehood, but the opposite of a profound truth may well be another profound truth. So it's not to say that truth is relative, but it's like my experience of truth and reality can be very different from someone else's. And yet when we can somehow put those together or hold them in tension, we may get insight to even a larger reality that we need to understand. And listening is the first way that you begin to do that. So what are some of the benefits of listening? I think listening does a number of things. It helps me understand how someone else who's made in the image of God could come to such a different conclusion than me. Even if I'm still sure they're clearly wrong, it helps to humanize the other person as I listen to understand how they got to, how they worked themselves to such a different place. And that's not an important thing, to begin to humanize people who we disagree with. And it's a lesson we can learn even in our own country today. In conflict, also, listening helps surface the issues that need to be dealt with. And sometimes it even exposes the thing that we're fighting for is actually not the main thing. And as I said before, there's an underlying fear or a trauma or an injustice that's underneath what the sort of demand is. And so you don't know that until you begin to listen and to understand where people are coming from. And then I think listening forces a moment of humility on me, in which I don't get to be heard, but I'm forced to be still and truly hear someone else. And this in and of itself can produce one of the greatest benefits of listening to understand. And that is, it makes the person heard feel like they're heard, feel understood. Sometimes just being heard and understood, it doesn't solve the problem, but it opens up the possibility to begin to deal with the core issues that divide us. And this is true whether you're dealing with communal conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, whether you're dealing with issues like race and racial injustice in America, or whether you're just dealing with interpersonal, you know, issues like with a spouse or a neighbor or something. Like, sometimes it's just having someone understand that they actually are being heard and understood lowers the temperature in a way that then gives you a new space to do something. When you're not listening, which is what we're seeing right now, they're not listening to each other in Israel, Palestine. They're just firing at each other. And this is not the moment to do that. But what you have to do is take advantage of those moments when you're not in the heat of this conflict to find ways to do that. And that's the great tragedy of what we're seeing now, that there's no movement ever made when there's not this kind of outright violence. There's so little movement being made to really listen, to understand, and try to find those ways to address the core issues.
Well, you said a lot there. You mentioned Paul Tillich. And so when I hear the name Paul Tillich, Brian and I connected. I mentioned Brian was the director of the Frederick Buechner Center. Paul Tillich was Frederick Buechner's systematic theology professor. So we like that. And then when you talk about holding realities in tension with each other, there's so much, not only in our American political culture, but certainly within the church today, where things are very, very divided, and people often seem to want resolution where somebody wins and somebody loses, instead of being able to live in tension with different ideas. And there don't have to be winners and losers all the time. People can live with different ideas, and conflict is not necessarily a bad thing. Conflict reveals
that's right
things, right? Yeah,
exactly. And then, that's exactly right.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, Todd, if you can give me a concrete story, or give us a concrete story of something that opened your eyes the first time. You mentioned getting on the ground and meeting real people. Tell us about a real person that you met in Palestine, and how that affected you and changed you.
I almost need to tell multiple stories, because what I really always want to be careful to do is to understand for folks to understand the sort of fullness of this, is you have to humanize everyone there. And so I just have so many stories I'd always love to tell. I'll tell one story to start that sort of captures that. So I'm in the early days of Telos and going there, I met some folks that are continue to be sort of heroes of mine, even as they've become dear friends. There's a woman named Robbie Damlin, and she's a Jewish Israeli mother who is from Tel Aviv, and her son David was in graduate school, and he got called into the reserves to reserve duty with the Israeli military back during this period in the early 2000s called the Second Intifada. And he was overseeing a checkpoint, a group of men that were manning a checkpoint in the West Bank, and he was killed by a Palestinian sniper. And the Israeli military came to her door and they knocked her in the door and they said, you know, your son has been killed. And the first thing out of her mouth was that you may not kill anyone in the name of my son. And she's not even sure where that came from. But there was this immediate reaction that there is no revenge here. And so don't go on a path of revenge on behalf of my son, because that's exactly what happens there. And you hear it right now. If you read the papers, one side will say, well, we did this in response to this. And the other side, we're doing this in response to that. And there's this sense that it's a tough neighborhood. And if you don't act in that way, then you're done for. So you have to always sort of punch back. And she said, no, there's no revenge. And that set her on another journey. And she ended up finding a group of people who had also lost their children in the conflict, and yet half of them were Palestinian. It's a group called the Parent Circle. And I think they even have an essay in this book. And they're amazing people. So about 600 families, about half Israeli and half Palestinian, each have lost a direct family member in the conflict. And they've come together to say, no revenge, and we're going to do the work of reconciliation. And her core partner for many years in this has been a Muslim Palestinian father named Bassam Aramin. And Bassam was one of the, he'd served time in an Israeli prison for some activism when he was a teenager. And he came out and formed a group called Combatants for Peace, which is also in the book. And he's one of the founders of this organization. He becomes known as this kind of peace activist, a former fighter who joined with former Israeli soldiers. And they came together to sort of be these advocates for conflict resolution and peacemaking, which is amazing in its of itself. And during that time, his 10-year-old daughter was shot in the head by an Israeli border policeman outside her school in Jerusalem. And she was killed. And he joined the Parent Circle. And these are two people who shouldn't be friends under any other, in any imaginable way. They've each lost a child in this horrible conflict, and yet they've come together across those lines of difference to be these amazing voices for reconciliation. And so when you see people like that, and then you see Americans who love to fly their pro-Israel flags or their pro-Palestine flags here in these very exclusive ways that discount the other, and then you realize that, you know, that there are real lives on the line, and that these are people who've, you know, even if you don't agree with all their politics, they've come together not just to work for reconciliation, they've also come together to oppose the Israeli occupation and to argue for a different kind of reality there. And not everybody loves that message, but they've earned the right to be heard. And they certainly show us how cheap some of our activism can be here. And so those are the folks that have completely turned me upside down. And as I've become friends with so many of them, because there are so many amazing people that are part of this organization, you also find that peacemakers are often not, they're not superheroes with superpowers. They're ordinary people like the three of us on this call, but through these extraordinary and awful circumstances, through this crucible of this unimaginable kind of horror and grief, they have become some of the most amazing people. And they are sort of in that way, kind of modern day prophets that show us a different way to live together. They give us these insights about how we were meant to live together, and they're voices that we should listen to.
That's great. That's a moving story. And I think about, you said that many of the groups that you take are Christian groups, and many of them would approach what they're going into already thinking that they know the answers. And certainly we've seen within the within kind of the white evangelical church a really strong pro-Israel stance over the years. I'm just curious, when people that have that background go and encounter reality, what are the kinds of discussions, and particularly theological discussions, their view of God and what's going on there that arise from the trips you lead?
Well, sometimes it just helps people to decide which theologies they want to sort of draw from when they engage in something like this, because so many have an eschatological, you know, frame or an end times view of this. And then they get there, and the reality is that, you know, you don't have to have a certain eschatological view to not be doing harm in the situation, but you have to be able to put that in some kind of proper place and kind of leave that in the hands of God. That, like, let it, he'll work out whatever he's going to do in terms of the end times or whatever. And you can find other theologies to engage that allow you to better work on behalf of all the people that you're meeting on these trips. I mean, I always just remind people that Jesus said, love God and love neighbor. Whatever our theologies are, if they don't filter well through that, if they don't, you know, work, if they're not sort of allowing us to demonstrate love of God and neighbor, then either the theology is wrong or we're just not operationalizing it right. And so that's a kind of a starting thing is that. But I think there's a lot of things that, a lot of conversations that happen for Christians on these trips that are really important. You know, questions about the connections between peace and justice. The Bible's full of that. And yet we don't often understand that. I mean, Martin Luther King gave obviously great insight into this when he said, peace is not the absence of tension, but it's the presence of justice. He was speaking out of a tradition of Hebrew prophets when he said those words, right? This is not something he made up, but it's timeless and true and transcendent. And so Christians often don't understand those connections until they begin to see what that looks like and what injustice perpetuated over time and not dealt with and having no channel to be dealt with, what that looks like and how it is disruptive of peace. And so that's an important one. I think just questions that people have about what did Jesus mean when he said, blessed are the peacemakers? What was he really talking about? What does it mean that enemy love is somehow at the heart of the Christian story? I mean, you know, that's the whole sort of Christian message that we were at enmity with God and God made things right. And God did that entirely by submitting himself to crucifixion. That's the center of the passion narrative. And then in that way, the center of Christianity. And so what does it mean for us to be a people who engage in that kind of enemy love? And then one of the big ones for a lot of particularly conservative white evangelicals is how is the work for justice and the work for reconciliation both personal and communal? Because I think for like a lot of people like me, a lot of white Christians, we can say we want racial reconciliation here at home, for instance. We just don't want it to cost us anything. But you can't get to true reconciliation on issues like race in America or in solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict without dealing with histories and injustices and systems and structures of power in the same way that, you know, just creating a new system without the opportunity for hearts to be changed doesn't yet necessarily yield a better outcome. You have to do all of these things together. But again, a lot of Christians have this sort of this minimalist view of what reconciliation is, and it's all entirely interpersonal. It's all about just, you know, interpersonal relationships. And that's really important, but it's completely insufficient. You have to be willing to take on systems of injustice and broader context in which things take place. And that's a huge part of solving conflicts. Now, my old colleagues at the State Department would often always just preference that. You know, we want to sort of do the geopolitics and sort of ignore this idea that actually people also need, you know, if they're living together, they need to, there need to be ways for people to deal with their, you know, with the true work of coexistence reconciliation as a part of cementing all of this. It all goes together. But I think it's really insightful for Christians to start to think about systemic injustice and from a certain segment of the American church, at least. And that's an exciting thing to be able to open people up to, but it's also very uncomfortable for a lot of folks.
Yeah, because then you're not talking about something, a conflict that's going on thousands of miles, you know, I don't know how many thousands of miles, 8,000 miles away from home, something like that. You're talking about their own backyards. You're talking about the streets and the communities exactly. where they live. Yeah.
And that's what led us to do the work in the American South. So we were taking all these folks there, and when they were coming back and they were saying, you know, I don't just have a new way to kind of see that conflict. You've given me kind of a whole new set of glasses to see the world. And I come back and I see our own challenges here, especially around this sort of historic legacy of racial injustice in America. And I'm thinking, I've got to find ways to live this out here too, which is what led us then to be responsive to these folks and try to design a trip experience here in the United States that tells a sort of more, a fuller version of our own American story that allows us to understand our own history in ways that then allow us to then figure out what are we going to do about them. And part of that is the legacy, the ongoing legacy of racial injustice that was there from the earliest days of our country, bound into the system.
Yeah, and in your chapter, you speak about and your organization, one of your goals is mutual flourishing. And so what's mutual flourishing mean for the white evangelical church, the white church? I shouldn't just lump it evangelical, the white church as well, Robert Jones's book that Brian sent me, by the way, White Too Long, does a good job of revealing that it's not just the, we kind of lump it into the evangelicals, but it's the entire white church, Catholic, Protestant, evangelical that has perpetuated this system. But if we truly are committed to mutual flourishing, what's that mean for the white church?
Well, I think, first of all, just at a basic level, commitment to mutual flourishing means the recognition that I can't have for myself and my children and my tribe and the people like me, the things that I want, the good things I want for them, while not being willing to work for those same good things for my neighbor. Mm-hmm. And it's not enough to just kind of want that for my neighbor, but I actually have to be willing to commit myself to working for those things for my neighbor, especially when my neighbor is differently advantaged than me, where they're more vulnerable than me, whatever. Like, I have to be willing to work for those things for others. We have to start by learning and acknowledging that there are times in which our theologies and our political ideologies have been and are weaponized against vulnerable people and to our own advantage. And that is a part of our story. It's not the whole story, but it is a part of our story. And so being more honest about our own story, it's not that we have to learn to care about others, because, I mean, most Christians I know are generous people who do care about people in need. But it's that we have to make who we care about less conditional. And we have to abandon any implicit or explicit sense that God loves certain kinds of people more than he loves others. And we have to broaden our definition of whose lives matter to God. And so in doing all that, we have to commit ourselves to understanding the dynamics of power and vulnerability that mark a lot of conflict that we experience, whether it's here or somewhere around the world. A commitment to mutual flourishing recognizes just how interconnected we all are. And then in a moral universe, my flourishing is directly tied to the flourishing of others, even the flourishing of my enemies. And that's where this really gets hard. And yet it gets really central to the Christian understanding of what the center of the gospel message is about. As Mother Teresa said, if we have no peace, it's because we've forgotten that we belong to each other. And I think there's no better way to say it than that.
Wow. So Todd, one other thing I'd like you to do is simply in the chapter you lay out that you have six principles of peacemaking and then six practices that accompany the principles. The principles obviously are great, but they don't mean anything get put into practice. So would you be able just to walk us through those and talk about the principles and the practices?
Absolutely. This is part of the work that we did over the pandemic. When we were not traveling, we used our time to sort of think about all the things that we have learned from these amazing peacemakers like the parent circle that I mentioned to you earlier and others that we've met in Israel-Palestine, in the South, in South Africa, in Northern Ireland, and other places we've traveled. And then we try to condense that into something that was really useful and usable for our people. So the principles are the foundations you build this on. You build it on things like the idea that change is always possible. The first principle is growth. And human hearts, as well as cultures and systems of power, can change. And so if you believe we live in a deterministic universe, then this is not the work for you. But we don't believe that. We live in a dynamic universe and that we have agency and that hearts can change and systems can change and that it is our responsibility in the time and place we live to be participant in that. And from a Christian understanding, it is really the central part of our salvation is that we are invited to join Jesus in his redeeming and redemptive work in the world. That's the kingdom of God. That is the work we get invited into. Our salvation is not just a ticket to go to heaven when we die. It's an invitation to be participant with Jesus in his redeeming work in the world. And that, in central to that, is this idea that transformation is possible. Second principle is equity, that true equality has to be actively won. We're all created equal, but we have to work to create systems of power that allow everyone access to the same opportunities. And that's true here in America, that's true in Israel-Palestine, it's true throughout the world. A third principle is that peace and justice are intertwined. And so I've already quoted King, but I'll do it again because it's so profound. True peace is not the absence of tension, it's the presence of justice. if you work for peace without justice, you're doing unserious work. That's the rainbows and unicorn kind of peace, right? Empty and dangerous. If you work for justice, though, without some concern for healing and reconciliation, that can degenerate into violence and revenge or just flipping the tables. So these things are the shalom of God and the justice of God are all intertwined. They're all part of the same thing. Fourth, relationship. Authentic relationships across lines of difference is what fuels transformation. And again, that's right there in our mission statement. We form communities of peacemakers across lines of difference. We believe right relationship is the core of peacemaking. And so as a part of that, intentionally cultivating relationships across lines of difference provides space for individual transformation. I mean, when I cross the lines, it opens up the possibility for my own transformation. This is Henry Nouwen. And Nouwen has this great quote about Christians have this obligation to enter into these difficult spaces in the complexity of life. And when we do that, we open up the possibility for our transformation. And when we are transformed, we then open up the possibility for greater societal transformation in ways that we would not have thought possible. And that's a paraphrase, but that's very much Henry Nouwen's sort of, you know, one of his central points in his beautiful book, Reaching Out. And I think that's really central to this idea. He talks about converting the hostis into the hospice, and those are Latin words, but the enemy into a friend. And that's what you do through relationship. Fifth principle of peacemaking is nonviolence. And again, quoting King, nonviolence is a way of life for courageous people. Active nonviolence promotes freedom and justice, and it's grounded in the spirit of love and hope. When you look at what's going on in Israel-Palestine today, I will completely condemn all violence from all sides that's taking place right now, because it's morally wrong and it's counterproductive and it's destroying lives and opportunities and futures. And at the same time, I deplore all other sorts of violence that don't always look like rockets and bombs and aerial campaigns and that sort of thing, too. There's lots of ways to be violent. And peacemakers increasingly are always looking for ways to engage in nonviolence as a way of life. And the sixth principle is mutual flourishing that we've talked about already. But the end goal, or the telos, which is the Greek word, is mutual flourishing. It's this idea that you do the work of justice always with the orientation toward mutual flourishing, toward the idea of a better reality for everyone. And then that, following that, we have the six practices. Yeah. And the first is listen to understand. We've said that one already. And I've kind of unpacked that already. But again, Paul Tillich has the perfect quote to that. For that, love's first act is to listen. The second practice is holding competing truths in tension. And we've unpacked that a bit too, because I talked about the work of Niels, the insight from Niels Bohr about, you know, one truth may actually augment another deep and profound truth. And in that one, I actually think about my own story sometimes. My ancestors were English colonists who came here to Virginia in the 1700s before they eventually made their way to Arkansas, and then I somehow made my way back. But they came to Culpeper County in the 1700s. And when I talk about what America is, that's going to inform my experience of America is arising from that. There were Africans who came to Culpeper County the same year my ancestors came, under very different and brutal enslaved conditions. And their descendants have also a story of America that may sound very different from mine. And again, it's like it's not that one is right and one is wrong. One is more dominant than the other. One's had more airtime than the other. But they have to be held together to understand. Third thing that we talk about in terms of practices is owning our own agency and responsibility. We own our duty to leave this world a better place than we entered it. We embrace discomfort and uncertainty, which often signify and catalyze growth. And yet, this is really critical, and I think Shane talks about this in the book, we act with humility, recognizing that peacemaking isn't primarily about outcomes or egos. We're not here to be heroes, we're here to be servants, and I think that's really important. The fourth practice is that we center the leadership of the marginalized. Being near or proximate to those most vulnerable and listening to community-based leaders are two of the essential foundations of effective and ethical peacemaking movements. Those closest to a problem we believe often hold the most significant insight about how to solve it. And so those who pay the greatest price of an unjust system often develop their own unique perspective on how to transform those systems. We honor their resilience and experience and expertise by amplifying their platforms and raising their voices. And at the same time, we don't abdicate our own responsibility and unique ability to lead within our own communities. So just because I'm not African-American doesn't mean I don't have something to say on this. I follow the leadership of people who are more vulnerable than me, but then I speak into my own community using what ability I have, what agency I have there, especially to try to bring about change. And I've been so shaped by this, especially by our friends in Israel-Palestine. All of our activism is here in the United States, but it's always informed by the people that we know there on both sides, including our staff. And they help us understand the arguments that we should make. And I think it's so important to lean into those voices. Fifth thing is self-interrogate. And I think this one is really critical, especially for people who are in positions of power or, you know, who have more privilege, for instance. I have such a limited ability to change others. I have almost no ability to change people who are on another tribe. So I'm Christian. My ability to change Jews and Muslims is almost non-existent, right? I have no credibility to speak into those communities. If my politics are Republican, I have no ability to really change the Democrats, for instance. And so I can easily point out, you know, I can call out hypocrisies and I can tell them where they're wrong. And I can feel really good about myself at the end of the day when I've done all that. And I have no impact. The most important thing I can do is learn to be an internal critic, starting with myself. And this is very connected to the Christian practice of repentance. So I start with my own complicity, my own biases, my own hypocrisies, all the stuff that I need to deal with. That's where it starts. And then I use my voice to become an internal voice of critique within my community, trying to call my own tribe to a different posture, trying to help us understand our own complicity. The other side may be wrong, maybe more wrong than my side. That's not the point. The point is that my own transformation, as Henry Nouwen says, opens up the possibility that even my enemies might be changed. And I think self-interrogation is where we start with that. And it's so hard to do because we have, you know, news services now that confirm, only affirm our own opinions and biases, you know, like we self-select in so many ways into groups and conversations where we just are told who the bad guys are and they're not us. And when we have to find more and more ways to be self-interrogated. And then the final thing is to strive for beloved community. Again, very connected to the sixth principle, which was mutual flourishing. Our telos is not the defeat of enemies. It's the personal and systemic transformation that allows for mutual flourishing and reconciliation and the creation of what Martin Luther King called the beloved community, or what Jesus called the kingdom of God. That's the goal. We form communities that in composition and practice model the world we strive towards. It's joyous, that's intentional, that's reflective, that's action-oriented, and that replaces unjust systems with just peace. And I think that orientation toward the beloved community is what makes peacemaking distinct, even from some other kinds of activism. We are pursuing justice always with an orientation toward healing. And that's the beauty and the power that it opens up the possibility for a different kind of future, not one that in which the tables are turned, but in which that all might, even enemies might have the opportunity to be transformed.
Wow. Well, that's great. This has been really rich. If people are interested in your organization, where should they go? Where should they look?
Yes, we are on the internet at telosgroup.org. So feel free to go to our website, and on there you can sign up to receive our newsletter. Not a newspaper. We're a little more cutting edge than that. We're not sending out an old print newspaper, although I still get one every morning and love to hold it in my hand. But I'm a dying breed. But we have a newsletter that we send out every other week, so we don't wear you out with emails, but we do try to communicate with you and give you some analysis on events, not just in Israel-Palestine, but other issues from a perspective of peacemaking and other resources. And you'll also then be able to get on our list to learn about webinars and other learning opportunities that we have and just other events that are going on. And so that's a good place to start. You can also find the principles and practices of peacemaking that I just went through on our website. We also have a podcast channel So we have two channels. One is called Undaunted, and you can find it wherever you get podcasts, you know, on Apple or Spotify or wherever. And Undaunted we have one season of the stories of peacemakers from around the world, some from Israel, Palestine, some from other places. And then we have an ongoing channel. It's called The Weekly Check-In, and it's every week, like sort of a Telos take on the news. So we do two news items usually, usually one from the Middle East and one from here in the U.S., and then we try to kind of analyze them and talk about them from the perspective of peacemaking. And that's newer, but it's an ongoing weekly thing that you can check out.
So it's telusgroup.org.
That's right.
And then it's a podcast, Undaunted, and a podcast, The Weekly Check-In.
That's right.
Yeah, great. And then, Brian, if people want to pick up your book, which I would recommend that they do, where can they find the book, How to Heal Our Divides?
Well, probably the best place is just that website, How to Heal Our Divides. Just all spell out, howtohealourdivides.com. And at that location, you can order the book. You can also find out about all the organizations like Telos and the book contributors like Todd. They're all listed there with links to their websites and their social media. It's meant to be a way to raise awareness about each of these great groups and hopefully help people decide which is the best fit for them to get involved in and support, whatever that means, right? You know, for each individual, whether it's monetary, whether it's volunteering, or whether it's subscribing to their emails and whatever the case may be. That's the intent of the entire project.
And then if people are interested in the writing things that you do, writingforyourlife.com is the best place to go for that?
Yes, absolutely.
Great. Well, I really appreciate Todd and Brian, both of you, joining us today. And I just wish you the best on this book and the best on your work. And we join in praying for an end to this violence that's happening right now in Israel, Palestine, and for God's blessing on both of you. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for listening to the Reformed Journal podcast. Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes, like us on Facebook, share this podcast, and until next time, may the peace of Christ be with you.